Following is a class by His Holiness Devamrita Swami on Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita Madhya Lila Chapter 8, text number 69, given during the 2014 Recharge Festival in Otaki, New Zealand.
I will be addressing the theme of the heart and how to follow your heart. According to parampara. Everyone wants to be carefree, creative. Everyone wants to basically do what they want to do. Is there a place for that in bhakti? That is the question. We'll hear from the dialogue between Ramananda Roy and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Nano pachara krita pujanam arta bando prem naiva bhakta hridayam sukha vridhutam sya yavat shurasti chatare jalata pipasa tavat sukhaya bhavato nanu bhaksha peye. Ramananda Roy continued. As long as there is hunger and thirst within the stomach, varieties of food and drink make one feel very happy. Similarly, when the Lord is worshipped with pure love, the various activities performed in the course of that worship awaken transcendental bliss in the heart of the devotee. I'll do the next text also. I'll just read the Sanskrit. Krishna bhakti rasa bhavitam mati kriyatam yadi kuto bilavyate tachalolyam api mulyam ekalam janma koti sukratai nalabhyate. Translation. Pure devotional service in Krishna consciousness cannot be had even by pious activity in hundreds and thousands of lives. It can be attained only by paying one price. That is, intense greed to obtain it. If it is available somewhere, one must purchase it without delay. Purport. The previous two verses are included in the Pajavali, an anthology compiled by Srila Rupa Goswami. Verse 69 refers to devotional service and faith, and verse 70 refers to devotional service rendered out of intense greed. The first is devotional service rendered in accordance with the regular principles. And the second refers to spontaneous loving service of the Lord without extraneous endeavor. Henceforward, the basic principle underlying the talks between Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Ramananda Roy will be spontaneous loving service to the Lord. The regular principles, according to the injunctions of the Shastras, are necessary insofar as one's original dormant Krishna consciousness is not spontaneously awakened. An example of spontaneous action is the flowing of rivers into the ocean. Nothing can stop this flow of water. Similarly, when one's dormant Krishna consciousness is awakened, it spontaneously flows to the lotus feet of Krishna without impediment. Whatever will be spoken henceforth by Ramananda Roy, based on spontaneous love, will be agreeable to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and the Lord will ask him more and more about this subject. Om Gyanatimanandasya Gyananjana Chalakaya Chakshun Militangena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Sri Vasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. We promised you that we would speak about doing what you want to do, following your heart. very popular subject matters today. And indeed, sometimes we wonder, as we consider taking up the bhakti process, or even after we have taken up the bhakti process, we wonder, what about my heart's inclinations? And what about my personal creativity? And why those rules and regulations, formulas for doing this, procedures for doing that? It seems to be so much. And all I want to do is be natural. I want to just see the bhakti process as a chance for my heart to flourish. Well, naturally, everyone wants to feel that their heart is flourishing. Indeed, you want to feel that you're thriving in heartiness. So how does the bhakti process relate to that? Sometimes we can even intimidate ourselves and discourage ourselves because we're thinking, there's just no room for my heart to express itself. There's no room for my heart to do as it likes. These verses from the Pajavali, spoken by Sri Ramananda Roy and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, can clarify our situation on all levels of bhakti. What is going on in the heart? And what should go on in the heart? So what does Ramananda Roy mean when he says, as long as there's hunger and thirst within the stomach, varieties of food and drink make one feel very happy? Similarly, when the Lord is worshipped with pure love, the various activities performed in the course of that worship awaken transcendental bliss in the heart of the devotee. So, let us consider this verse. As long as there's hunger and thirst within the stomach, then when you eat and drink, you feel very happy. So the whole point of the sadhana bhakti process, that long list of rules and regulations we have, right? Such a long list. Or is it amazing that in the age of Kali, in this age of degradation, any attempt, any slight attempt to rein in the mind and senses is considered to be an injustice? An imposition, that's the word. Could it be that we're so hypersensitive to the slightest regulation of our beloved mind that we consider that the bhakti procedures, and there's so many of them, right? The bhakti procedures will check our heart's inspiration, our heart's expression. Perhaps we can consider that we make such a big thing out of a little bit of regulation in life. What Krishna calls the regulated principles of freedom. It's chapter 2 in Bhagavad Gita. That makes us think. Regulated principles of freedom. These principles allow me to become free and creative and genuinely hearty rather than artificially. Artificial heartiness, artificial heart expression means you're acting under the gun of material nature, Trigunamayi. So, the illusory energy has you fooled. You're following your heart. You're following your creative inclinations when all you're doing is submitting to the three modes of material nature and being dictated. Prakate kriyamanani gunai karmani sarvasa. How are we going to understand this? From within the clutches of Maya, you cannot understand Maya. This is a fundamental mistake that we can make. That within the darkness of illusion, I can understand how the illusory energy works. Impossible. By taking up the bhakti process, anyone can experience that indeed the darkness starts to diminish and the sun starts to rise. Anyone can experience that. And any sane person wants that darkness to diminish, at least partially. You don't want pitch dark night, at least twilight or dawn, you know. Maybe not full illumination of midday sun, but anyone can experience the diminishment of material illusion by chanting Hare Krishna and following a few rules. Anyone can feel that. But the question is, beyond that point, what happens? What's my future? What's my destiny? We heard yesterday, His Grace Kalakant Prabhu, appealing to you to look at bhakti as a lifetime career, a lifetime unfolding, and have a plan how you're going to go the distance. Going the distance means that indeed, gradually, your real heartiness will manifest. If we just give it a chance. It's like back in the 60s. The popular slogan, all we are saying is give peace a chance. Well, what the Shastra is saying, all the Shastra is saying is give your heart a chance. Give your heart a chance to really develop and manifest. Don't be like an arrogant teenager who, well, I'm 14, 15, I know everything. Don't be like that. Understand that your life in bhakti is going to be a gradual unfolding of spiritual talents, spiritual awareness, and gradually you'll come in touch with the real you, the real heart, your real desires. When you're very sick with a physical ailment, you don't consider that you're seeing clearly, you're hearing clearly, you're breathing clearly, you're smelling clearly. Remember having a very bad cold. And everything is stuffed up, and you know the example I always give. If there's a feast day and you have a very bad cold, even though you can't taste anything, you'll still sit down and gorge, right? You've got to try. You can't smell anything. You can't taste, but it's a feast. You've got to squeeze something out somehow. But you know your sense perception is distorted. Similarly, in the beginning of bhakti, it takes a little humility for us to understand that we're actually not knowing our hearts. We're not knowing our real creativeness, our real desires. We may have some preliminary idea, but we don't take it so seriously enough that it's going to impede our bhakti execution. Everyone has notions, everyone has intuitions, fine, but we don't take them as the be-all and end-all. For example, sometimes you hear young devotees say, oh, I like Jagannath better than the other deities. I'm more attached to Ramchandra than Krishna. Or sometimes it is said like that. These are sentiments. Devotees older in stature will appreciate the sentiment. Oh, that's nice. But no one takes it so seriously. It's like when little kids, maybe you may remember when you were a 5 or 6 year old, little kids would say, oh, he likes you. She likes you. No adults take it seriously. Like little kids. You don't chastise the kids. You can't talk like that. But you just don't take the sentiments to be rock solid and something substantial. So similarly, at the beginning of our bhakti, and for some years, we may have intuitions, inclinations, fine. But we don't take them to be the beginning and end of the world. So what is going on in our heart? And how does the process of bhakti relate to our heart? Ladies will easily admit that what goes on in their heart is all important. Men generally will, you know, they won't go there right away. They're not so sure about their emotional content. Ramananda Roy is quoting a verse referring to how to perform the bhakti process for developing hunger for Krishna, thirst for Krishna. He's saying, as long as there's hunger and thirst, then when you eat and drink, you feel happy. But without the hunger and thirst, how are you going to be happy? How are you going to be hungry? So the whole process of sadhana bhakti is to make you hungry. Then you can be happy. When you sit down, you know, when you sit down for lunch, prasad, and you're hungry, then you can relish. If you have no appetite, what's the use? So the whole point of sadhana bhakti is to develop your appetite, make you hungry. In other words, we shouldn't assume that right from the very beginning that we have such a significant appetite for Krishna. Actually, anyone who takes up the bhakti process, even momentarily, is a special person. But still, out of practical humility means the humility that will get you places in bhakti. It'll be transformational. Out of practical humility, not out of just sentiment or accepting things dogmatically. I'm told I must be humble, and I'm told that I shouldn't take what I think so seriously. I'm told I should ignore my heart. I'm told all my intuitions are totally bogus. Practical humility means, yes, I'm feeling things. Yes, I'm intuiting things. Yes, I have my desires and I have my inclinations, but they're not the ultimate at this stage in my life. They're not the sum and substance of everything. So you take note of them, but you don't allow them to dictate every aspect of your existence. Just like parents take note of their children's sentiments, even their children's silliness. I can remember some of my own silliness. I've been living in the temple for a few weeks when Srila Prabhupada came in Brooklyn Temple, New York. I wasn't even shaved up yet, as they said back then. I wasn't even wearing a dhoti and kurta. I was wearing a kurta, but I was wearing regular pants, you know. And so I remember, this is before Guru Puja started, was instituted for Srila Prabhupada. Instead, the devotees would all offer their obeisances to Srila Prabhupada after greeting the deity. It was known to be Asastan. So I remember doing that, offering my obeisances and thinking to myself, now I am fully surrendered. That was April of 1973. I wasn't even 23 years old. But yeah, it was a good sentiment, right? But I would be a fool to take it so seriously. So, Ramananda Roy is speaking a very insightful verse that helps you to view the sadhana bhakti process in a very deep way and beneficial way. Of course, you could take it, the definition of sadhana bhakti, the rules and regulations of bhakti, you could take it straight on in a very deep but, concise way. What God brother, Kalakanta Prabhu and I, and Jai Srila Prabhu also knows him, Brahmatirtha Prabhu, in his conversations with Srila Prabhupada, You'll find perfect questions, perfect answers, that little book. He asked Srila Prabhupada, what is sadhana bhakti? Any rules and regulations of devotional service? Srila Prabhupada answered very succinctly, sadhana bhakti means you have to do it because I say. That's too much, right? That's really retro. Oh, so 20th century. But now, as humanity has become more aware and enlightened, those kind of answers might make you feel uncomfortable. Ramana Roy is giving you an enhanced definition. How are you going to develop hunger and thirst? In other words, right now, your appetite isn't what it should be. I don't know if you've ever had digestion problems. How many here have had digestion problems sometimes? So you know what it's like. Either you have no appetite to eat, or you eat and it doesn't digest. So Ramananda Roy is concerned about congestion in the heart. That your heart is not able to pump properly. And that's to be expected in the beginning of bhakti. So he's saying, if you follow the proper process, the hunger and thirst will develop. Just like when there's proper appetite, you can eat. You know the story, you may have heard me, many of you heard me say, from Mahabharata about Krishna, Duryodhana, and Vidura. Duryodhana, the chief rascal of the Kauravas, was famous for throwing banquet lunches that were unparalleled in terms of material opulence, in terms of amount of preparations. If you know anything about Indian weddings, the main point of the Indian wedding, besides the actual marriage of the man and woman, the main point is to give prestige to the bride's family by offering the most preparations at the banquet, even though most of them are not going to be consumed. The whole point is, how many preparations are at your wedding reception? You can ask Bhagavad Gita, how many preparations are at yours? 13. That was modest, right? Who's up there in the numbers for their weddings? Anyone? How many preparations at your wedding reception?
I think it was 22 or something.
Often there are hundreds. So, Duryodhana was famous for having these enormous banquets for lunch. Materially sumptuous, material overload. Manifestation of the Kshatriya, martial pride. So he heard that Krishna was in town. And Krishna was related to Duryodhana's family by marriage. So Duryodhana thought, more or less to himself, he thought, even though I can't stand him, he's related to me in marriage. And so I'll invite him for lunch. Who could refuse my lunch invitations? I'm famous throughout the universe for my spread that I offer for lunch. What actually happened? Krishna decided to visit the lowly devotee, lowly in terms of material opulence, Vidura. Of course, so high in terms of spiritual opulence, but in terms of material opulence, Vidura was very lowly. Krishna didn't even tell him that he was coming to visit. He didn't even tell him he was coming for lunch. And in fact, Krishna was running to his house. Why? attracted by the bhakti. And so Vidura opens the door, and there's Krishna, the greatest uninvited guest. So Vidura sits Krishna down, and then he and his wife begin to try to get something together to offer to Krishna, who's the surprise guest Krishna's come to for lunch. So that is where you see the famous example in Nectar Devotion, where Vidura and his wife are so absorbed in ecstatic love that she's trying to offer Krishna bananas to eat. She's peeling the bananas, and Vidura and her offer to Krishna the banana peels, and they're throwing away the pulp because they're so absorbed in ecstatic love, they don't realize the mistake they're making. And what is Krishna doing? He's eating the peels. That shows you that actually on the platform of pure love, what you might consider a mistake is not. The guiding principle is the pure love. That's why Krishna is eating banana peels. If you're going to understand Vrindavan, you're going to understand Braj Leela, you need to understand that the governing principle is simply ecstatic, spontaneous, pure love. It's something different than material perfection. Just like you've heard that sometimes when Krishna becomes overwhelmed by the love of his dearest consort, he starts milking a bull instead of a cow. And his dearmost consort starts embracing tamal trees because they're dark bluish color. And meditating on dark blue rain clouds. So Krishna ate the banana peels. But this pastime is not over. Duryodhana caught up with Krishna somehow. They met. They said, Krishna, you need to show up for lunch. My lunches are so famous. They're so opulent. You didn't even come. What's going on? Why? What was Krishna's response? Very instructive, of course. Krishna told them, in order to eat, there have to be two things. The person has to be hungry, and the person offering the food has to have love. I wasn't hungry, and you had no love. That's why I didn't come. Krishna had no appetite. No bhakti there. Whereas Vidura had Krishna eating banana peels. And here is Duryodhana offering incomprehensible banquet of hundreds of preparations in a palace, and Krishna didn't come. So that should teach us something, this pastime. What about my hunger and thirst for Krishna? That's my mission. When we look at the basic procedures of bhakti, the rules and regulations, it's not that much. It's just we're Kali Yuga sensitive, you know. Really not that much. When we understand that the bhakti procedures are for developing a hunger and thirst for Krishna. And right now, we're artificially not fully attracted to Krishna yet. We have great fortune just by thinking about taking up the bhakti process. Such great fortune. With knowledge, we see that we need to make advancement. Advancement means developing hunger and thirst for Krishna. It's not that spiritual advancement is some kind of nebulous, vague thing. It's all about an appetite. When that appetite for Krishna develops, then you start to realize what your inclinations are, what your talents are, what your desires are. So bhakti can appear to be a little tricky because On the one hand, until we're perfectly in our constitutional position again, we understand what is our direct relationship with Krishna. Until that time, you can't say that you know yourself fully. At the same time, we have to take into account the inclinations and desires of our temporary body and mind. So how to combine all that, coping with the temporal as well as coping with the eternal? This is why bhakti requires guidance. If we allow the temporal concerns, well, this is how my body and mind are feeling right now, that's got to be the way to go. That's a mistake. And if we prematurely just focus on our eternal nature without taking into account our conditioning, then we can be indeed fanatical. We can do our spiritual progress harm. How to do the balance? That's the question. Therefore, guidance is required in bhakti. How to take note, how to acknowledge our mind and body that are encasing the spirit soul, and how to understand that most important is the spirit soul. This all requires experience, wisdom, guidance. If we just go too much to the temporal side, we've wasted our life. If we prematurely try to act like we're Paramahansas, beyond, totally beyond the modes of nature, then we can make some rash mistakes in bhakti. So how to hit the mark? That requires counsel, it requires guidance. As you always explain, how to live in this world, which is material, and at the same time be spiritual. Actually, as one becomes more advanced in bhakti, you're actually starting to see the material energy as belonging to Krishna, and therefore you're starting to see the material energy as full of spiritual possibilities, because ultimately everything is spiritual. Vishnu Shakti Paraprota is explained that all of the energies of the Supreme Personality of Godhead are spiritual, but some of the energies act in different ways. So much so that the external potency seems to be material, even though it's Krishna's. It's acting that way. Like in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, I'm everywhere. In other words, my energies are everywhere. But then again, I'm not there. My ekstamidam sarvam jagat avyakta murtina. Mastani sarvabhutani cha. It sounds like word juggling, doesn't it? Everything is me, but then again, everything is not me. I'm everywhere, but then again, I'm not there. A deep meaning of those verses is that everything is my spiritual energy, but because you're a non-devotee, for you, I'm not there. It's Krishna's selectivity in allowing sense perception. Because he's Hrishikesh, Lord of the senses. Ishwar controls the senses. So yes, all my energies, they're coming from me. That's why Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Mama Maya Dratya, my material energy is impossible for you to overcome unless you surrender to me. Unless you do things my way, take my instructions. But still, it's my illusory energy. So as you start to make advancement in bhakti, you see the material energy differently. You see it as laden with opportunities to serve Krishna. And that way, you understand your vision is starting to become spiritualized. And gradually, your vision, in the more advanced stages, gets to the point that as soon as you see something material, immediately you connect it to Krishna, and you're no longer seeing the material energy. At the peak of bhakti, there's the vision that Ramananda Roy had, certified by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Ramananda Roy was so much in love with Krishna that whenever he saw something so-called material, immediately he saw Krishna. In other words, immediately, spontaneously, he connected the energy with the energetic source. And that's why Lord Chaitanya quoted that famous verse to him. Whatever the Mahabhagavat, the first class devotee, sees, although he's looking at apparently ordinary moving and non-moving forms of the material world, because immediately he remembers Krishna, he's immediately seeing Krishna. So that is at the peak of bhakti development. And we need to hear about the peak so that we know what we're aspiring for and what we're shaping our lifestyle to attain. Otherwise, out of forgetfulness, and that forgetfulness can happen in any ashram, we just become ground under. Oh, you have to do this, you have to do that. Oh, my life is so high pressure and there's so many demands on me. You've lost sight of the goal. And so naturally then, not naturally, but naturally in terms of material thinking, you start jettisoning your spiritual practices, your hearing and chanting. That would seem to be a practical approach to pressures of the day, right? Something's got to give. Can we have some more air in here, please? Something has to be removed from your life, and unfortunately, it's probably going to have to be hearing and chanting about Krishna. That is optional. Everything else has to be done. But we have to move out of our life what is optional, what causes the least damage, we think. And that calculation, the four Kumaras in the fourth canto of Bhagavatam say, is the greatest mistake you can make in life. They say there's no greater mistake that you can make in your life than to consider something a higher priority than your own Krishna consciousness. No greater mistake in life. And that mistake can happen in any ashram. Sannyasis can get so overloaded by traveling. The logistics of traveling are so intense. Sometimes I even think, in Goloka Vrindavan, there'll be no airports. No more boarding call announcements. No more worrying, you know, how heavy your baggage is. So, yes, any ashram, the pressures are there. The brahmacharis, you have to do this, you have to do that. Typical brahmachari schedule, you know, distributing books, cooking for prasad distribution, and they have to read minimum 2 hours a day, and chant nice rounds, and keep their ashram clean. This can seem to be too much sometimes, right? You're all smiling. No, it's not too much. But I can tell you that sometimes that, you know, they feel pressed for time. Of course, good management means to, as much as possible in this world of upheaval, make a stable situation so that one can practice bhakti. And, of course, those who are in the household ashram know best for themselves those pressures. So my point is that every ashram can have an excuse why they lose their taste for hearing and chanting. Why so many practicalities have to take the center stage. What does Bhagavatam say? Dharmas. What is it? Shamaipi Kevalam. Vikshvaksena Katasuya. No padaya yadivatim shama evikeva. You may perform all your occupational duties nicely, but if you have no taste, if you lose your taste for hearing and chanting about Krishna, shama evikeva, all a waste of time. Any occupational duty, any lifestyle, that's the test. Where is your taste for Vishvakshen Gata? Vishvakshen, plan your expansion of that. Where is your taste for Krishna Gata? That is the success of your ashram and the failure of your ashram, no matter what it is. If you have not revived your appetite, if you're not feeling hunger and thirst for hearing about Krishna, it's all been a waste of time. So this is why Ramananda Roy is giving this example. He's saying to you, the bhakti practice is for developing hunger, so that you're hungry and thirsty to hear about Krishna, to engage in Krishna's service. And then, what's the next level? Very famous verse. Krishna bhakti rasa bhavi tamati kriyatamyadi kutopi labhyate tatra lolyam api mulyam ekalam janmakoti shukritarna labhyate. This verse is all about greed. That is the perfectional stage of bhakti. The greed stage is beyond the hunger and thirst stage. The sadhana bhakti, the rules and regulations are met not to restrict your heart, repress your heart and ignore your creativity. No. The rules and regulations of bhakti are meant for developing real creativity, real hunger, real thirst, so that one day you'll get to the point of greed, which is a spontaneous platform of devotional service, raga bhakti. I always ask this question. How many of you remember what it's like to be greedy? There's lust, and there's greed and anger. What does Krishna explain in Bhagavad Gita? Chividam, Nadakashyam, Dvara, Nashanamatma. There are three gates leading to hell. Lust, anger, and greed. Every sane person should give these up. But the perfection of bhakti is the pinnacle of greed. To be drowning in greed. That's the perfection of bhakti. Material lust, your craving, your wanting, your desiring, and your material mind is telling you, when I fulfill this lust, I will feel peace. I will feel satisfied. I'll get the monkey off my back, and I can breathe. That's hallucination. I'm going to just let go of such a long time of not doing what I want and getting what I want. This, whatever lusty activity, this is going to satisfy me. Right now, I can see and almost feel the emotional bang I'm going to get from this activity. At university outreach engagements, I describe research by behavioral economists. It's the latest discipline combining psychology and economics. Because economists have just realized that how can you understand everything through dollars and cents when human beings have conscious behavior? So maybe we should start looking at the conscious behavior of human beings in terms of economics and not simply the bottom line of money. So they've analyzed that human beings have an inbuilt problem. It's called miswanting. It's not that they can't get what they want. That's a problem. getting what you want. But also, they don't know what they want. But they think they know what they want. So what does that mean, to think you know what you want? It means not that you say, well, I don't know what would be better for me. To have a broken leg or to go for a nice walk on a sunny day. There's no problem in understanding what to want amongst those two. But if behavioral economists point out that you don't know what you want in terms of overestimating the emotional bang you're going to get by doing something. The basic dilemma of the materialist, the material activity, is that you project in your mind, when I have such and such attainment, when I have such and such acquisition, I know I'm going to feel satisfied. I can just feel it right now. How I'm going to feel when I do it, when I get it, when I have it. This is the basic mistake of the conditioned soul. You look out at material nature, bodies, minds, objects of acquisition, objects of possession and control, and spontaneously you visualize immediately how I'm going to feel when I connect with that sense object. And that's what drives you on in material life. That's why the Bhagavatam explains, material life goes on in your mind. Therefore, if you can control your mind, you save yourself so much trouble. Material life means uncontrolled mind. So basically, the behavioral economists have just come to the conclusion of some things are already in Bhagavad Gita. The uncontrolled mind cannot refrain it cannot stop from visualizing. You see clearly, when I do this, I'm going to feel like that. But they say, you're always wrong. Always. You always overestimate the bang. But you can't help yourself. Even they admit that they won the Nobel Prize for coming up with this research, but they say, in any situation, they can't control themselves, even though they have all this academic knowledge. It's like one Nobel Prize winning economist was saying, I thought that by moving out of the city into a big house in the country, that I would be happy and my wife would be happy. And so we moved outside the city to a big house in the country, and then the first couple of days was wonderful. We were feeling our big house, our spacious land around the house. But then soon, we realize we've got to commute to work every day. And there's traffic. And so we were practically spending no time in our big house. We were spending most of the time on the road in our fancy car stuck in traffic. And then in the big house, when we were the time that we could actually be there, we were lonely. And then we had to worry about who's going to clean the house. Should the task of cleaning the house be gender designated or not? And then we started to fight. And because we were living in a big house in the countryside, we had, you know, no other neighbors to go and let off steam on, and so we just took it out on each other. So in the end, we divorced, and looking back, the economist said, I can see it was all because I had this illusion in my mind that all I have to do is this, and I'll be happy. But even though I study these things, and I'm the world's expert in research on this, I couldn't control myself. So lust is not the worst thing. What do I mean by that? Lust leads to anger because your desires can never be fulfilled. the sooner you realize that, the more you save yourself so much trouble. You won't be frustrated if you have a practical understanding of desire. Because my lusts can't be fulfilled, I don't act on the lusts, and therefore I won't be angry. Angry person means full of frustration due to unfulfilled desire. But lust and anger, they're not the worst thing. Of the triad of lust, anger, and greed, material greed is the worst. Because here's what happens sometimes in the course of ordinary life. Sometimes you lust and you feel, that was really good. That was all right. Yeah. Some magic moments. Wow. Maya is merciful. Not all that bad. Yeah, I know the Bhagavad Gita verse. Daivyesha gunamayi. I know it's illusion.
Yeah.
What's more, what about dukkhalyam shastradam? Krishna saying this material world is temporary and miserable. I accept all that. Yeah, I'm a believer. I got my neck beads on, yeah. I say Haribol when I see them. But although this material is temporary and miserable indeed, some good moments. Magic moments. Yeah, it's feeling all right. Not so bad after all. Even though it's temporary, I know it's temporary. But yeah. Now, let's be clinical in our analysis. The Shastra explains that those moments of temporary illusory satisfaction are your worst enemy. Because that's what binds you to material existence so tightly. The feelings of temporary satiation, temporary fulfillment. You connect with the sense objects and yeah, I feel like I'm at peace with myself, at least for a few hours. That's your worst enemy. These so-called feelings of satiation, of fulfillment. Because you'll become greedy. I had those few magic moments. All I need is more, and more, and more, and more. There's no such thing as material satiation. The lust leads. If the lust seems to be successful, then in comes greed. Can't get enough. Everyone has the experience of stuffing themselves while eating, right? Is there going to be a pizza day here? Not this. Who's in charge of the pizza? Is there no pizza? You got better things in store. Right? Everyone knows. You sit down, pizza and ice cream. Sannyasis do it also. And the normal tendency, definitely not the sannyasi, but the normal tendency is you want more and more and more and more, right? You're going to go for it until, you know, you've got the pizza coming in, you know, up past your... right? And the ice cream coming out of your ears, right? Right? What's going on? You have this natural, it seems to be natural intuition, this natural feeling that if it's good, have more. And have more because it's good and you felt good. One good moment should what? Be followed by another good moment. That's the psychology. How can you let a good moment exist in of itself, right? If you get a good bang, it must be followed by another bang. And another, and another. This is extraordinarily magnified when you're engaged in illicit activity, men who view pornography. A huge problem these days. The internet makes breaking the regular principles so easy. The men don't even have to try to hook up anymore. It's just all there on the internet in such fantasy that beyond what you could ever, what a man, what a lusty man could ever dream of. In other words, the people who make the pornography have totally misused a human intelligence to devise the most fantastic fantasies to just grip the male mind. All for profit. So, scientists have said that for men who are caught up in pornography, their brain transforms. Kalakanta Prabhu and I were discussing this a few days ago. The normal brain is not wired to have one peak moment after another in rapid succession on and on and on. The human brain is wired that there's some peak moment and then you calm down, and there's quite a substantial interval before, again, you try to have a peak moment. But what the pornography does is just hits you with a rapid-fire, endless sequence of peak moments. And so therefore, the chemistry of your brain actually changes. And you become addicted. It's not exactly to the pornography that the man becomes addicted to. He becomes addicted to that one bang after another, on and on and on and on. Because that's how the pornography, I never seen it, but that's how the pornography is arranged. Just one after another. As long as you stay on the internet. And so your brain changes. Your neurochemistry changes. And you start looking at life in that way. What's wrong? I'm not feeling the... You start judging every moment of your life in that way. In other words, you go crazy. Modern society has successfully come up with a way how to drive the men even more crazy than normally they are. All for profit. And the ladies are wondering, what's going on? What's wrong? What's wrong? What's wrong with the guy? I mean, what's wrong with my husband? Because the internet presents these fantasies in such a way that the guy's thinking, wow, this is great. I don't have to deal with a female mind. I get the peak performances one after another, you know, without, you know, this is great. And no lady in her wildest behavior could match what's on the internet. It's not possible because it's all fantasy on the internet. This problem is affecting the whole world. Not simply even in India, but especially in India. Because the internet allows you to have a public profile of being, you know, wholesome and dignified, but then, in the privacy of your own laptop and computer viewing, you can degrade to the infinite depths of Kali Yuga, but in public. So again, this is an extreme example. Unfortunately, it's so common. This is an example of false projection. So much so that your brain changes, the chemistry of your brain changes. In other words, the lust has become intense greed. That is the greatest tragedy of material life. So again, and this is a point Prabhupada explains in a purport in Bhagavad Gita. When you think that you have obtained some satisfaction materially, even though you know it's temporary, and you know what Krishna says, Dukkhalayam Shashvatam, you know all the Bhagavad Gita slokas, you've heard them if you don't know them. Still, you think, that's all right, yeah, it's not so bad. That feeling is the greatest enemy, because that's where the greed comes in. You're going to want more and more and more. One good moment cannot stand alone. That's the Kali Yuga principle. If there's been a good moment, there should be the next good moment, the next right after, rapid succession as much as possible. That's a good life. So we all know what greed is like. It's the worst enemy in material life. But it's the greatest friend in spiritual life. So the successful completion of the bhakti process is when you have greed for Krishna. But that greed is not on the platform of sadhana bhakti, but it's what sadhana bhakti, the rules and regulations of bhakti, are going to take you to. The rules and regulations of devotional service are meant to turn you into a greedy man and a greedy woman. Greedy spirit soul for Krishna. And that greed is so exalted that this verse is saying it can't be had by hundreds and thousands of lifetimes of pious activities. Hundreds and thousands of lifetimes of good karma won't develop this spiritual greed. And that spiritual greed is what's required to attain pure bhakti. If it's possible to obtain the pure bhakti by buying it in a store, do it immediately. In other words, it's what you desperately need. But of course, it can't be attained that way. The only price for pure bhakti is the intense greed to have it. And that intense greed is the culmination of the sadhana bhakti process. The example is given about the river flowing into the ocean. Queen Kunti gives that example. Oh Krishna, may my attraction ever flow to you, just like the Ganga flows into the ocean. And here in the purport, Srila Prabhupada writes, an example of spontaneous action is the flowing of rivers into the ocean. Nothing can stop this flow of water. Similarly, when one's dormant Krishna consciousness is awakened, it spontaneously flows to the lotus feet of Krishna without impediment. So whatever is spoken by Ramananda Roy to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu from this point on will simply be on the Radha platform, spontaneous attraction to Krishna. That's where our heart is. Those are our natural inclinations. So we always keep that as our highest guiding principle while managing our temporary existence in this world. We're mindful of our temporary inclinations and desires, temporary intuitions. At the same time, our beacon is how. The beacon that we see in the darkness is how we're going to be greedy for Krishna. How can we develop that? What is one lifetime for developing that? It's nothing. So this is how we can judge our ashram success, no matter what ashram we're in. Am I on track for developing greed for Krishna? The first stage I must get to, hunger and thirst to hear about Krishna, an appetite for Krishna's service. Then you know you're on track. See, bhakti is not an all or nothing process. Either I'm a pure lover of Krishna or I forget it. It's Jaya. No, there are signposts along the way. So first we want to get to the point of hunger and thirst for hearing about Krishna, for engaging in Krishna's service. Then we know the next stage will come, the greed, the raga, the spontaneous attraction. You'll see that in Krishna's pastimes, that greed. Krishna and the cowherd boys, they're having fun with hunger. The cowherd boy said to Krishna in the forest of Vrindavan, Rama Rama Mahabaho, Krishna Drishta Nirbahana. Oh Rama, they're addressing Balaram first. Why? Because they know Krishna likes that. Balaram is Krishna's older brother. So, calling out, Oh mighty arm, Balaram, Mahabaho, Krishna Dushta Nibarana. Oh Krishna, the destroyer of all enemies. We've got an enemy for you to kill. What is it? We're hungry. We need some prasad. You can kill so many demons, so certainly you can take care of this one. So, are the cowherd boys materially lusty and greedy? No. They want Krishna to eat, so therefore they're saying, we're hungry. Their satisfaction is only Krishna's satisfaction. They're saying, we're hungry, and also, it's time for more pastimes. What are you going to do next, Krishna? So, Krishna came up with a plan. He said, nearby, there are some brahmanas. And these brahmanas are doing a yajna for pious activity, elevation to the heavenly planets. They're materialistic brahmanas. They think they're following the Vedas, but they don't know the goal of the Vedas. So they're so attached to their rituals for good karma. How to enjoy material. Go to them and ask for some food from their yajna, their sacrifice. Don't mention my name first, because they think I'm an ordinary person. Mention Balaram's name first, because they know Balaram to be of Kshatriya birth. And they think I'm just a farm boy, I'm just a village boy, cowherd boy, so I'm lower. So that was the tactic that Krishna gave the cowherd boys. So, the cowherd boys approached the brahmanas while they were doing their yajna, their Vedic sacrifice. The cowherd boys stood before them with folded palms and then did full dandavats spread out on the ground, addressing the brahmanas, Hey, Bhumi Deva, O earthly gods. We're here by the order of Krishna, but we're sent by Balaram. They forgot. Jiva Goswami says their attraction is mainly for Krishna, so they garbled Krishna's instructions. At first, don't mention my name, say Balaram. But yeah. We're executing the order of Krishna, but we were sent by Balaram. please, can you give some food from your yajna? Noticing the brahmanas were silent. The cowherd boys tried to prod them a bit. You're a dharma vittama. You are the knower of dharma. That was their way, sarcastic way of saying, you guys don't know what you're doing. You don't know the Vedas. Brahmanas weren't saying anything. The acharyas point out what was going on in the brahmanas' mind. Well, why is Krishna and Balaram, why are they hungry? And the cowherd boys would intuit to them that because they're herding cows, the most exalted activity. Well, why didn't they come themselves and get some food? Well, that means leaving the cows, and you can't do that. Therefore, we're here. That was intuitively what was going on. But externally, the brahmanas said nothing. They didn't say yes, they didn't say no. So the cowherd boys went back to Krishna and reported. We didn't even get an answer from them. What was Krishna's response? He laughed. Anything Krishna does, whether he smiles or laughs, seems insignificant, but everything Krishna does is important. What was the point of his laughter? Number one, he wanted to show the coward boys, don't get angry with brahmanas, even if they're ignorant. Number two, that's the way of begging. It's not always that you go out to beg and you get what you think you're supposed to get. You've got to be detached. Number three, why was Krishna laughing? Because he's om purnam, he's perfect and complete. He doesn't need any food, he's just having fun. So there where he laughed. This is just Leela, this is bad time. Krishna's full of everything. But he's having fun with his cowherd boys. And most of all, he wants to reward the wives of the Brahmins. He explicitly stated that. So Krishna said, all right, go out again, but this time approach the wives of the Brahmins. They are my dear devotees. So the cowherd boys approached where the wives of the Brahmins were. They were at home. What were they doing? Sitting and what? Gossiping? No, they were sitting and discussing Krishna Katha, the perfection of home life. And the acharyas described that the wives of the Brahmanas were well decorated with ornaments supplied by their husband, but more importantly, they were decorated with the emotions of ecstatic love. So the cowherd boys approached. And Krishna had told them, don't say that I'm hungry, because they love me so much, if they hear I'm hungry, they'll suffer. Just say that I'm nearby, and they'll figure everything out. In other words, they'll know how to serve me just by hearing I'm nearby. So the cowherd boys, here's how their presentation to the wives of the Brahmanas went. Krishna and Balaram are nearby. All the wives of the Brahmanas went into samadhi just by hearing the holy name. They went into a trance just by hearing the holy name of Krishna and Balaram. So the cowherd boys, they're really quick. We've got to bring them out of trance. Krishna and Balaram not only are nearby, but they're hungry. Krishna told them not to do it, but they were using their intelligence how to fix the situation. How to bring these ladies out of samadhi. They're hungry. So the ladies in their samadhi, they're cursing themselves. What are we doing in samadhi? What the hell with this ecstatic trance? Krishna's hungry. We gotta get it together. We gotta come out of trance. This is pure bhakti. The devotee doesn't even care for his or her own ecstasies. The devotee is simply looking at the service to Krishna. So when they heard Krishna was hungry, they finally came out of their trance, brought about by just by hearing Krishna's name. And then the cowherd boys, they saw, well, these techniques are working. They added a bit onto the situation. Not only are Krishna and Balaram hungry, but his companions are hungry too. So the wives of the Brahmanas gathered together food and they rushed to present it to Krishna. And they found Krishna on the bank of the Jamuna, beautifully decorated with forest flowers and minerals, dressed so gorgeously, infinitely gorgeously. They saw Krishna with his left arm around a friend, and in his right hand he was twirling a lotus flower. Nothing Krishna does is devoid of meaning. So by his twirling the lotus flower in his right hand, he was showing two things. Number one, your hearts, ladies, are like lotuses. and I've got them in my hand. And number two, my lotus-like heart is in your hands. So when they first saw Krishna, what did they do? They took the vision of Krishna in through the opening of their eyes into their transcendental heart, shut the door of their heart, and embraced Krishna tightly. This is the perfection of yoga. Yogi namapi sarvesham madgatenam tarapu. Krishna says at the end of the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, the topmost yogi is the one who's always connected to Krishna in pure love. So these wise of the brahmanas are showing that. So all of this pastime originated from greed, but pure greed. It seems like just hunger, even greed for eating, but no, it's about greed to please Krishna. Greed for more of Krishna's pastimes. That's the whole point of bhakti. When the wives of the brahmanas went home, their husbands realized what a mistake they made. And they began to curse themselves. The hell with our three births. Our birth, biological birth in a Brahmin family. The hell with our Brahmin initiation. The hell with our yogic initiation into Vedic sacrifices. What's the use? The hell with it all. Our wives have not studied Vedic knowledge. Of course, in our Krishna conscious society, all the ladies have a chance to study Vedic knowledge. In this case, the Brahmanas were saying, our wives have not studied Vedic knowledge. They haven't done any austerities. They haven't done any Sankirtan, no outreach. No cooking Krishna food, Krishna prasad, they haven't done any of them. Yet, they have achieved the ultimate goal of life. They are pure lovers of God. And we've missed the boat completely. They were condemning themselves that way. They even said, our wives are our gurus. We accept them. We are their disciples. So then they resolved, let's go right away to Krishna and we'll find him and beg forgiveness for our offenses. Is that what happened? Practical considerations, right? The real world, the so-called real world. They wanted to go meet Krishna and beg forgiveness, but then they realized, Kamsa's spies are everywhere. He may see us going to Krishna, and then our lives could be in danger. Drop the idea. Practical considerations, so-called practical considerations, overpowered the most practical consideration. Whereas the wives ran to Krishna like the river is rushing into an ocean. They are the most practical. They live in the real world. So the brahmanas, the men, never went to meet Krishna. The wives' appetite for Krishna was caused just by hearing about Krishna from the flower seller ladies and other lady merchants who would go to Krishna's village. They would spread reports. He's so beautiful. Just by hearing, the wives of the brahmanas became attracted. Thirst, hunger, greed. How will we always be mindful of these points? By daily hearing. That's why the Shastra says, whatever ashram, occupational duties you have, if you haven't developed a taste, if you lose your taste for hearing Krishna's glories, engaging in Krishna's service, it's all a waste of time. We want to be greedy. And before being greedy, first we have to be thirsty and hungry. That's what our heart wants. So yes, we're mindful of our temporary, external, superficial intuitions, inclinations, but we don't take them to be the most serious thing in life. Just like when you, the example I gave, when you hear little kids saying, the boys and girls, five-year-old boys and girls amongst each other, well, he likes you, she likes you. Adults, you know, all right, you're little kids, you talk like that. You don't punish them, lock them up, but you just, you're little kids, you'll grow. Similarly, we need a holistic view in bhakti of our temporary situation and our eternal situation. Then there's balance.